Hi, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm real grateful to be here tonight. Thank you, John, for your sharing. You've surely been through a lot the last few years, and it's a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous and to your higher power that you're here. Can everybody hear me okay? Well, you know, every speaker gets up and says, I'm really grateful to be here. I don't think I ever heard a speaker get up and say, you know, I really hate being here, and I don't want to be here with you guys. And I think we always mean it. But I want you folks to know that those are not just words to me tonight. I am really, really grateful to be here. You folks have got a marvelous conference out here. And the reason it's a marvelous conference is a bunch of terrific people that put it on. And I want to thank every one of you. I was sitting before the meeting started and thinking, I don't think I've ever had the experience at a conference of making so many new true friends in a matter of a couple of days as I have here. You guys are just great, and thank you so much. Thank you for everything from the basket in the room to your hospitality to your love and for picking a slate of speakers except for Saturday night. That's great. And actually, the wonderful things that I've heard from this podium, I sort of feel like I could get up and say, I second the motion and sit down and let's all go. But I don't guess that's what I'm up here for. So that being the case, we're going to have some divine intervention. And I need a lot of divine intervention. That's the bad news, is that I need a lot of divine intervention, not just to give a talk, but I need a lot of divine intervention to get through a day of living. Let me tell you, by the way, the biggest reason that I'm grateful to be here tonight. All those things are so true about this conference being special and all the new friends I've made and the old friends that I've got to see again and be with. But the main reason I'm grateful is this. We've already heard talk this weekend about the fact that the book tells us that our daily reprieve is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You see, I truly don't know. Now, by the grace of God and the help of you guys, good sponsorship, the 12 steps, and the fact that I'm blessed out of the blue with the ability to do a whole lot of things I didn't understand, didn't agree with, and didn't think would work. On account of that, by the grace of God, I've been sober a day at a time since April the 9th of 1981. And I don't need an applause on that. God needs some applause on that, and you guys do. So thank you. And I truly do know today that I might die sober and that I might die drunk. And the reason that's important to me is there were a number of years in my sobriety that if you had asked me, Don, are you going to die drunk or sober? I would have given you the absolutely politically correct AA answer, that all of us are just sober a day at a time. Nobody knows that. And I think I would have passed a lie detector test. I don't think I was lying. But there was something inside me that had become unable to envision me dying drunk. And God took care of that about 12 or 15 years ago. I can't relate it to any event or anything. It just happened. And I can just as easily today envision me picking up that drink on some later day and dying the mad dog death that I know is coming for me if I do that, as I can dying sober. And we've already heard talk this weekend about that daily reprieve being contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You know, one of my many problems in reading the big book is that I already know what it says. Kind of hard to learn a lot if you're reading something that you already know exactly what it says. And for several years sober, I knew what the book said my daily reprieve was contingent on, my spiritual condition. And I got to tell you, as long as I thought my daily reprieve was contention on my spiritual condition, that was scary. Because now some of you guys have been sober a long time, you may have gotten it down pat, and you may never have any days when you wake up and the head's spinning, and you're obsessing on something, and you're so scared about something you can't remember the last word you just tried to pray. You may never wake up and feel like you're cut off from AA, feel like you're cut off from your higher power, but I still have those days. So if my daily reprieve were contingent on my spiritual condition, I'd be in a lot of trouble because there would be days when I just might get struck drunk. But thank God that's not what the book says. The maintenance of my spiritual condition. If I'd driven a car here, I would have a car sitting out there that would have a condition. And there wouldn't be a thing on earth that I could do to wave a wand and immediately change the condition of that car. On the other hand, there would be a process of maintaining that car, which is all action over which I have 100% control. And I want to tell you, when I really looked at what's there in black and white in that book and saw what it said, it was like flipping a light switch. My daily reprieve went from something like, man, I really hope I've got it because I hope my condition is good enough, to something that I earn every day for that day, only for that one day, by the action that I take in that day. What that means is I can wake up feeling all discombobulated and wake up feeling like I'm cut off from everything, not wanting to get down on my knees and say those words, and in my mind convinced it won't do any good if I do. But I can make myself get down there, and even though I'm sure the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling and my brain's spinning every minute I'm down there, I can get down there and do it. I can get up and look at my meditation books. Maybe I can't remember the last word I just tried to read. Clear, it's not doing any good in my mind. Then when I start to make a gratitude list, I have to sit there and look at it for 10 minutes to come up with something like my eyes. And then I start listing things that a fellow would be grateful for if he had any sanity. You know, because I may not feel grateful for a thing, and that's another thing I've learned. I've learned that this nice, warm, fuzzy feeling of being so glad I've got things, that's not gratitude. That's the reward for gratitude. What gratitude is the action. If you want to see whether I'm grateful for something, don't listen to what I tell you. You watch how I treat it by my actions. I'm not grateful with my head. I'm grateful with my feet. And that's the gratitude that keeps me sober. That nice warm feeling that God's got me in the palm of his or her hands and everything's okay. That's the reward for faith. That's the reward for gratitude. Faith and gratitude are the action. They're actually doing those things. But anyway, getting back to my day when I woke up discombobulated. I'm going to my office and I'm sitting in the office with one of my big deals, and I hope I get a chance to talk about big deals tonight because I love big deals. And why wouldn't I love big deals? There's nothing that's so absolutely certain to guarantee my failure and misery as having big deals. And all of my life, anything that's got anything to do with me, I blow it up into a great big deal. The truth is, I know that any time I make a big deal out of anything, and that includes my health, that includes my kids, that includes my money, that includes my sex life, that any time I make a big deal out of anything that is not God and not these 12 steps, what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. And when I do that, I'm back into ego and I'm back into alcoholism. You let the same thing happen to your kids, your sex life, your money, your health. Man, it's not a big deal. I can tell you, all you need to do is just pray about that and go to meetings. Now, you need to help somebody else. You got to get out of yourself, for heaven's sake. That's the way this thing works, and it's clear it'll all work out. We just stitch, and God's got the pattern all taken care of. You let it happen to me, and oh, my God, it's the end of the world. You know, it's a big deal because it's me. what I'm really making a big deal out of is me. But I love those big deals. So on this day I'm talking about, I'm in my office and I'm eaten up with big deals. And the phone rings and the receptionist answers it, and let's say it's Joe. And Joe's a sponsee. And I tell all my sponsees right out front that for me to give advice on finances or romances ought to be a felony. But they keep on asking me about that stuff instead of just letting me be a guide through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's maybe the 8th or 10th time that Joe has called in the last 24 hours to talk about the girl. I'm sitting there with my big deal. I haven't got time to mess with Joe and the girl. But instead of telling my secretary, tell Joe I'll have to get back to him, I say, put him through. And I say those prayers that are miraculous every time I say them. I say those 11th step prayers to myself. Thy will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Joe rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood by him. And you know, I call that an 11th step prayer because it's in the 12 and 12, the prayer of St. Francis is, where it talks about the 11th step. And over the years, I've found out that the only time I am ever loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction is when I lay aside whether I am loved, comforted, or understood at all. You let me get concerned with me being loved, comforted, and understood. It's a law of the universe that I will not be loved, comforted, and understood to my satisfaction. The only way I can get it is to say those prayers and try to give it to you, and then it comes like a little butterfly and nestles on my shoulder for just a little while. And when I decide I like it and say, I love that, I'm going to keep it and start working on getting you to understand so we can start to communicate. See, before I got sober, I didn't think we could begin to communicate till I got you to understand me. Then I could work on getting you to love and comfort me. But at any rate, the reason those prayers are miraculous, other than what I just said, is that they make me something that I am not by nature. They make me a listener. And I can pick up that phone running those prayers through my head and say, good morning, Joe. How are you, buddy? What can I do for you? And I'm gone, and at noon there's a meeting over across the river from my office. I've been to that meeting a million times, know everybody that goes to it. The acoustics are terrible, and I'm two-thirds just stone deaf. I don't hear one word out of five that's said in that meeting. And doesn't matter, because I've heard everything they've got to say 100 times before. And here I am eating up with my big deals and so busy, but I can make myself go on over to that meeting and sit there and pray thy will be done, and remind myself, oh yeah, Don, you're fouling up again. You're asking the wrong question. You see, regardless of what it is, whether it's that noon meeting, whether it's coming to this conference, whether it's talking to a friend, whether it's something at work, if I ask myself, what are you getting out of this, Don, and think about it for about 30 seconds, the answer is always not enough. So it's just the wrong question. The right question for me is, what can I bring to this? And I make it through that meeting, and I make it through the rest of the day, and I'm sorry I dragged that out so much, but the bottom line is real simple. You see, because my reprieve is contingent on that action, that's the maintenance of a spiritual condition, on that day I have just described, I believe that the big book absolutely promises me that I will not get drunk because I have done the action on that day that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition. On the other hand, I wake up feeling like God and I are joined like Siamese twins and we're just going to go out floating through the ether and merge with the Tao. And I can decide that my whole life is a prayer. Why should I get on my knees? And when Joe calls, I can be engaged in higher spiritual contemplation of my belly button. And I can feel very warmly toward Joe, but clearly we can't interrupt my spiritual journey to talk about his trivial matters. And I may get drunker than Cooter Brown that day, despite the fact that I feel like I've got a great spiritual condition. And I really don't know how I got out on that, off on that. but it's okay. One place I'm really going to need divine intervention is I'm going to try to follow directions for a little while here. And I want to tell you, when your case is special like mine is, and my case is very special, you see, I've always been considerably smarter than the people who make the directions. I don't usually talk about that in public, but I've always known that. It doesn't matter what the directions are concerning. I know more about it than they do. And the people who make the directions are stone square Johns. They are the most conservative people on the face of this earth, and they're being advised by liability lawyers that are worse than they are. So what they're doing in the directions is they're trying to manipulate real idiots into doing things, so they overstate everything. So all my life, when I see or hear directions, there's a process that happens. It's automatic. It's not conscious. I have to sort of extrapolate as to what the directions really mean in my special case. So all my life, if I see something that says something like, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain just processes that, and I get something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. Next place I'm going to need divine intervention is to get me out of the way. I used to get up to give an AA talk and say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. Let me tell you, if I could get me out of the way, I wouldn't even need to go to AA. Getting me out of the way is no less impossible for me than it was in April 1981 when I got sober. I have to have the divine intervention. And those simple directions I want to follow for a little while tonight, of course, are to talk a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And another set of directions in the book that I really love and I hope that I follow. The book tells me that our personal stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our Creator. And I really hope my story carries that, because you see, when I first got exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was absolutely allergic to this God deal. The mention of it made the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck and insulted my intellect. And as far as this higher power crap went, you guys trying to soft soap it and slip it in on the left side, to me, I think that made me even madder than outright talking about God. I knew what you were talking about, and it would insult my intellect just as badly. So all that talk kept running me out the door. And I'm so blessed because I was allowed to live long enough and get run back in here by alcohol enough times, because I didn't have anywhere else to go, that finally I was able to take the hand that you guys had been extending to me and let you take that hand and lead me through these 12 steps that are the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those steps have led me back to a loving God I didn't even know was there. And that's the reason I'm alive today. My childhood, by the way, was spent on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky. And I want to tell you that my childhood wasn't a thing like I thought it was. Just not a thing. Up until I got sober, and I was 37 years old when I got sober, the lie detector needle would never have wavered when I told you the saga, and believe me, it far transcended an ordinary story. It was an extremely interesting and romantic saga about my pulling myself up by the bootstraps, by my iron will and sterling intellect, from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached. And I was so sincere that I'd usually have you and me both crying before I was halfway done with it. And I wasn't sober a week until I realized it was all a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. We weren't even close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and a lot of things that we wanted. And believe me, the heights were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. The truth is, on account of this ego disorder of mine, all of my life I've been more nearly mundane than my ego's ever been able to stand. And I expect that's true both drunk and sober. And looking back on the first 12, 13 years of my life, what was going on was what the book says. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles. And my first sponsor told me early on that what that means to me is that I've got a disorder of my ego. And I've had it all my life. And on account of that disorder of my ego, number one, without divine intervention, I will always, bottom line, let how I feel be the most important thing in the universe. I also am so obsessed with myself and how I feel without divine intervention and how I believe I stack up against other people that I get the only result possible from that self-obsession. So much pain and so much emptiness down inside me that I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can and or trying to stuff something in there to make me feel good enough that I can stand the way I feel without running. See, I've always been and remain today without that divine intervention, an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is real simple. I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something and not nearly good enough for the same thing at the same time. Too smart for something or somebody. And too dumb for that same something or somebody at the same time. That dichotomy, that conflict doesn't seem to bother me at all. The only thing that I seem absolutely unable to feel without divine intervention is okay for anything or anybody on the face of this earth. On account of that ego disorder, another part of what I was like, I've already given you a hint that I didn't give any consideration to the possibility that there might be a personal God, that there might be some power beyond me that actually was more important in the conducting and unfolding of every day of my life than my brain. Because you see, any thought of that, and my ego vetoed that big time, there couldn't possibly be anything more important in the actual unfolding of every minute, of every hour, of every day of my life than my little old brain. And on account of that same ego disorder, I don't believe I had any teachability or humility whatsoever until I got sober. And the reason I don't believe I had any teachability or humility is that I've never been able to remember a single time in that first 37 years of my life that I voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it, I agreed with it, and I thought it would work. And that still got a pretty good ring to it tonight. Why in the world should I voluntarily do something about my life if I don't understand it or I don't agree with it or I don't think it'll work? When I get honest, it's real simple. I've got a talking illness. My alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life. And I've always had an old crazy picture show rolling in the back of my head. And for me, recovery has not been those things going away. What recovery has been is that most of the time, I can recognize that they're not reality and I don't have to obey them. As far as my alcoholism talking to me, I believe that that is probably the most terrifying thing about my alcoholism. And let me tell you what it is. I don't believe my alcoholism has ever tried to kill me. And that's what terrifies me. Because I've nearly died from alcoholism dozens of times. But the reason I don't believe it's ever tried to kill me is I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether I live or die. And I don't believe my alcoholism cares whether you live or die. I believe my alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing, and that's try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to get it. It'll tell me something that might kill you or me or both of us. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another. It doesn't care. Just slings it all up against the wall and hopes some of it will stick. Well, if 100% of the time I could recognize that and say, that's just my alcoholism or my brain, and by the way, my alcoholism and my brain are one and the same thing. That's just them talking to me, and what I need to do is ignore it and go to a meeting or pray or wash the dishes or whatever. That'd be fine. But you see, my alcoholism is a many-splendored thing. It truly is. And I'm not saying this for effect. I really mean it. I don't believe there's any story of Don Major other than the story of alcoholism and the recovery from it. I truly believe that's the whole deal with me. And one really big part of my alcoholism is that if it's anything at all, it's a disorder of my perception, which, of course, literally means I don't always see things right. I don't always hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. The bottom line's simple. When I put that final veto in the universe in my little old brain that I'm not going to do it voluntarily unless I understand it, I agree with it, and I think it'll work, with what I've got wrong with me, I just put myself under death sentence. And I believe I stay under death sentence until I get that final say-so in the universe out of my little old brain. I got drunk first time when I was either 12 or 13, and that first night I got in an awful lot of trouble. I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover, swore all those Baptists around there were right, and I would never do it again. And it was really fairly effective. It was almost a week until I got drunk the second time. Because the magic had happened. Now, at the time, I didn't know the magic had happened. I didn't know that till after I got sober. At the time, all I knew was that for a few minutes on my way to puking and so on, I had passed through a right pleasant neighborhood. But looking back on it, of course it was magic. Real simple bottom line. Remember, without divine intervention, how I feel is the most important thing in the universe to me. And when I finally found something that made me feel good enough inside that I could stand the way I felt without running, for the next 25 years when I needed to change the way I feel, it didn't matter what it cost. And it didn't matter who it cost. And I believe that's very intertwined with my powerlessness over alcohol and the things like it. And I'm not going to give you all a drunkalogue tonight, but I will tell you that I didn't come here because it gave me the hiccups. From that first drunk until I got sober about 25 years later, not only alcoholism, but alcohol dominated everything in my life. I never apologized for my drinking. I never hid my drinking. I don't have a single memory of ever telling myself or anybody else I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything for me except make my mouth dry, give me a headache, make me need a drink, make me to get something to drink. Everything that happened in my life happened around alcohol, because of alcohol, in spite of alcohol. I'm very confident that in that 25 years I went to bed legally drunk. Of course, my Lord, they've got legally drunk down so low now, I probably woke up legally drunk over half the time. But I am confident I went to bed legally drunk over 80% of the time in that 25 years. But, of course, I didn't know I was going to bed drunk that much because the only standard I ever had for drunk was whether or not I blacked out. If I remembered everything, case closed, end of discussion, I was not drunk. School was real easy for me, and by the time I was 16, my egomania with the inferiority complex setting in. On one hand, I'd got in enough trouble with my drinking that I thought I better get out of that farming community before the house came crumbling down on my head. On the other hand, it was clear that a place like that couldn't hold one of my magnificence. So I left high school early and took a Greyhound bus 200 miles up to the big city there in Kentucky of Louisville. And I kicked around for 3 or 4 days and wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. They gave me a bunch of tests and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And the first semester I laid so drunk that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just pass out and come to, and of course blew the scholarship. So for the next 7.5 years I worked full time, went to school full time, and drank full time, and finished undergraduate in law school. And I've got very few memories of how that happened. It's all just a swirling gray alcoholic blur. Spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter Dana, who was my only child for over 20 years, I've got a 16-year-old son now, but Dana was the only one for a long, long time. Dana was born that same spring. Started practicing law in downtown Louisville, and I practiced for about 10 years with really pretty fair amount of material success. I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I've always had kind of a knack for getting publicity in cases that, you know, get a lot of attention. So I got a lot of ink, and I had made money, and I had things. And by the way, I wasn't nearly as successful as I used to think I was. And I'm not just talking about when I was drinking. I'm talking about the first several years I was sober. You know, as we stay sober longer, things come into a different focus. And I realize now that if I live and stay sober 35 or 40 years, I might have been a total failure. I don't really know, but the best I'd do tonight was moderately materially successful. And those are the things that I would stick in your nose when you suggested there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. And I truly lived insanely. During that 10 years, at least a third of the nights, I didn't make any attempt to go to bed. I either passed out or just changed my intake of things and kept right on going and went to court. During that 10 years, I began to use a lot of things other than the booze. And it's already been mentioned here tonight at the conference this weekend. Neither Bill Wilson or Dr. Bob could tell their story without talking about drugs. If they couldn't do it and don't do it in the big book, I don't know how in the world I'm going to do it. But during that 10 years, all those things were sideshows to the booze. The booze was the big tent. All those other things were things to change the effect of the booze, increase the effect, decrease the effect, help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was the big tent. February the 10th of 1978, I had been practicing law for about 10 years, and I was still holding on to my material world by my fingertips, but I was still holding on to it. I was remarried to my daughter's mother at the time. And as far as I'm concerned, the fact that I was remarried to my daughter's mother establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. Now, that's not because there's anything wrong with my daughter's mama. It's because in 24 years of sobriety, I've just sort of observed, and I'll swear, I don't believe in the history of the world anybody ever did that but us. I believe if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum getting in to try to protect themselves. But we do it all time, drunk and sober. You know, old Joe and Sue divorced, they'll probably get back together. I think we have trouble. I think words like divorced and married are just too confining, you know, for us. And the weird thing is it works for us sometimes. It's not even bad. It's just different. But anyway, hopefully that is my only sociological commentary of the evening. It is not in the big book. Feel free to ignore it, please. But at any rate, I was remarried to my daughter's mama. February 10th, 1978. That day I got full of scotch, cocaine, quaalude, speed, and vodka. I got hold of a lady that I'd been seeing who was not my daughter's mama. I had reservations up north of Kentucky at a resort, so I headed southwest to see my father. And until I get to the wreck, there was nothing unusual about that day. It was just simply the way I lived. I drove a Corvette off the road at about 130 miles an hour on icy roads. Did an awful lot of bad things to my body. Broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg. They had to do a bypass in the upper leg, take out a vein and graft it in to replace the artery, separated my pelvis and pulled my plumbing in two, so I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a suprapubic catheter, they call it, just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. I had a half dozen major surgeries that first year and was in the hospital for more than 6 months out of that year. It was 2.5 months before they stood me upright on an electric tilt table for the first time. The doctors told me early on that I would never walk again without braces on both legs and one or two canes, and that they did not believe we could find a surgeon anywhere that would attempt to find the ends of my urinary tract and put it back together so that I would ever have a urinary function. Now, for the record, and purely by the grace of God, because we know it was not me following directions, right? I've been sober about 24 and a half years, and I haven't owned a bracer or cane for almost 26 years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together. But I didn't know that that was going to happen. So my reaction to that prognosis was that after I got through about 6 weeks of intensive care and surgeries, I would lay in my hospital bed, and every single day for those months, my friends brought me in booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. Nobody ever said a word to me. And I would lay in that hospital bed, and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And then I'd give them my talk about the fact that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. And just because we've hit a little bump in the road, they're not going to hear me whining. So give me a drink and let's go on with it. And that's real insanity. And it's real powerlessness. I didn't go broke right away because a little law firm had built up around this other lawyer and myself. My daughter's mother, of course, was extremely disgruntled about the circumstances of the accident and divorced me finally right after the accident. And by the way, I don't make light of that. I'm only laughing at myself where I've been ridiculous. The way I've treated other people because of my alcoholism has been the source of an awful lot of amends work on my part. But I'm not going to fail to laugh at myself where I have been ridiculous. So that's what I'm doing, is I'm laughing at myself. I'm still not glad I hurt a single person I ever hurt. I don't regret the past, and I don't wish to shut the door on it, but I'm sure sorry I hurt those folks. And a lot of that hurt, all that hurt, if I could take it back, I would. But at any rate, she had had a belly full, so she divorced me right away, and I wound up married to the girl that was with me in the accident, who was hurt but not as badly as I. About a year after that wreck, I still had the tube in my belly and the catheter bag and the braces and the crutches, and I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use that word to be funny or cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in the Big Book, and my mama used that word. And by the time I got in that first asylum, the phenomenon of craving had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking, I just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop unless something intervened and helped prise me loose from alcohol. And when something did prise me loose from it, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like sit up in a chair. And by the way, for you newer folks, there's nothing mysterious about the phenomenon of craving. All in the world it is the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol. And some of us, like myself, have it from the very beginning. And if we're alcoholics, we'll all develop it if we don't have it, and it progresses. And I've never felt a physical force of any kind, including all the surgeries I've had, in my life that was as painful as each one of the last couple of hundred times I had to come off ethyl alcohol. Most destructive and most addictive thing I ever put in my body by far, and always my drug of choice. Well, they got me in that first asylum, and they got me through the 3 or 4 days, and they set me up in a chair, and for some reason thought an AA meeting might be a good idea in my case. So they had an AA meeting, had somebody get up and read the steps, got step 3. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him, and that insulted my intellect. So I climbed up on my crutches, and I straightened up my catheter bag, and I said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on over the telephone and called somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. That was somewhere around the first year of 1979, and I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81. I really don't remember much of that. But some things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie. I'm real grateful for that because I proved I wasn't going to hit bottom. I wasn't going to make the decision that is bottom. And, you know, that's something that I'd have died if I hadn't learned that. I thought this bottom, this mysterious thing you were talking about, we were like little dry leaves out here on the wind. And if we got blessed or lucky and got blown to bottom, Man, it's wonderful. We got to get in Alcoholics Anonymous, have friends, do the steps, get spiritual, make money, have sex, and everything. It was wonderful. But if you happened to catch a bad updraft and couldn't get blown to bottom, well, you just had to die a mad dog death. And it seemed like a peculiar way for a loving God to set up a universe to me. But my bottoms are not that anymore. My bottoms are decisions over which I've got so much control. And by the way, when I was drinking, forming an intention and making a decision were the same thing to me. If I'd formed an intention to do something, I'd tell you I've made a decision to do this. I'm very careful in sobriety that I do not call my intentions decisions until I am acting on them. That's how intentions graduate to decisions. I don't make decisions with my mind. I make decisions with my feet, just like priorities. Don't pay attention to what I tell you my priorities are. Don't pay attention to those lists I'll sit down and make for my priorities. You watch what I do. You watch what I give my interest, attention, and love to on a daily basis, and that is my priority. All the rest of it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. But at any rate, I wasn't going to hit bottom at that time as long as I had a Timex watch. I certainly wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. And the drugs brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded. And the state of Kentucky helped me out a little further right after that by jerking my law license. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity, and during that period she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on my only child in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to her again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my portion of the office building we'd built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things along those lines. The mortgage companies took the homes the ex-wives were in, and it was just all gone. And after all the material things were gone, my dad was on the farm in his late 80s with nothing but his Social Security. I went and stole that to keep on drinking on. And a year ago in September, I buried my only sister, my older sister Sarah, who had been crippled by polio as a child and lived her life as a hunchback, as a spiritual, intelligent, beautiful hunchback, but a hunchback, and endangered Sarah's life, using her and abusing her to keep on with the drinking. I burned every bridge. And for almost a year and a half, up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address. I lived on what I called the street in an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. And I lived every day of that with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism. And I'm not talking about some vague idea that I might die of alcoholism. I'm talking about something that was perched on my chest when I came to and was still perched there when I drifted into oblivion. And the way that happened seems simple looking back on it. You see, a good half of those 18 places I'm calling asylums had treatment programs based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, if I was able, sometimes between trips to the asylum, I'd go to a lot of AA meetings. So I had a head full of information about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it's one of my frequent and sincere prayers today, and this is not a joke, that I never, ever know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And I mean that prayer quite literally. And what would happen during that year and a half is one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. My brain would go, I know it works for you guys, but you don't understand how special my case is. You know, you don't understand how intelligent I am, for heaven's sake. And my God, I've played on such a broad stage, and my tentacles have just reached so far and touched so many. And I see things more clearly than ordinary people, you know. And I feel them so much more acutely that I'm just wounded by my own understanding. And I'd be apt to get teary-eyed about you simple-minded folks that could concentrate on those little silly symptoms of the booze and the dope. Of course I knew I was an alcoholic and a dope fiend too. But my goodness, those were just results of the real problem. The real problem was so much more complex than that, and I couldn't be simple-minded and babble about your myth of a higher power and go to your little group therapy sessions you call meetings and expect this terrible and magnificent complexity to go away. So it wouldn't work for me because I was so magnificent. And here's the nightmare, the absolute nightmare. The very next heartbeat, one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain would go, yeah, I know it works for you, but you don't know how bad I am. You don't know about the parts of me that are missing and always have been. You don't know that I've never been able to love anything or anybody, not even myself. You don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my life. You don't know that anything in my life that looked like it was even okay, much less good, is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got people and things left to get sober with and to get sober for. You don't know how bad I've been. If by some miracle I stayed off booze and dope for a couple of months, it would just be to be blown into by a sawed-off shotgun or spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible. Next heartbeat, it'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I'm so magnificent. And I was believing it both times, didn't know this thing wrong. Fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of Asylum Number 17 in Nashville, Tennessee, and they let me in. They told me later to keep me from dying on the street. They didn't think I'd live a week if they left me there. Stayed about a month, and it was time to kick me out, and I had no place to go. Of course, no home, no car, nothing, no clothes, teeth rotting out of my head. My roommate, I had a roommate in there that was a young fellow, and his family lived there in Nashville, Tennessee, and they felt sorry for me and said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days and let's try to figure out what to do with you. I went and lived with them a year on charity. And the first 6 months I didn't stay straight, but it got better. And I believe in my case I was in bad enough shape that I had to get better before I could begin to even comprehend or do anything. And during that 6 months I went to an awful lot of meetings. Most of them at a clubhouse there in Nashville that was called the 202 Club. And I got to where I could sometimes go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped, and that was a world record for me in or out of an asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that during that whole six-month period, they only put me back in one single rubber room. And, of course, at the rate I'd been going, I would have thought twice a year in the asylum was the picture of mental health. I'd have settled for it in a heartbeat. Late March of 81, I got on my most recent drunk, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka-slash-Listerine drunks, and I have truly drunk a barrel of both of them, and just parenthetically, I've got better memories of the Listerine than I do of that old hot pop-off. I can stand to smell Listerine today, but I can't stand to smell that pop-off, guys, I tell you. You know, nobody smell vodka. I can certainly smell vodka today a mile away. And, of course, I was taking everything that I could find during that drunk. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks. And I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville. And a loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks I was sober, I didn't have a clue that anybody was giving me any gifts or that there was a loving God. Because, you see, coming off that most recent drunk didn't feel any different than the 200 before it. Folks, I hadn't seen a burning bush yet. If I'd kept waiting to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could solve all of my unique problems, if I'd kept waiting until it felt like Alcoholics Anonymous was working for me to start blindly doing what you guys in that big book told me to do, I would have been rotting in a pauper's grave somewhere around Nashville, Tennessee for over 24 years. And I'm not guessing at that. I know it just with all certainty. The biggest gift that my loving God had given me was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I certainly didn't want to do them. I had no idea I had that gift. 3 or 4 days after that most recent gift, I stumbled back to the door of that clubhouse in Nashville, and I didn't think they'd let me in, and they really should not have let me in. In today's environment, they would not. They would have had a restraining order against me because I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They had caught me shooting dope in the men's room. They had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. about 2 months before I got sober. I was walking through that clubhouse, and a big old tall boy, about 6'6", by the name of Joe Wall, poor Joe died last year. Joe walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. I truly did. My knee-jerk reaction was, well, thank God they have finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But Joe went on, and he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, because we've never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that felt like an icy hand grabbing something inside me, and it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door, and they did let me in. In fact, I remember what was said and who said it. They said, "Yeah, Don, come on in. You're keeping us sober." And I said, "Well, y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live." And they said, "Yeah, don't drink, don't take, don't go to meetings." By the grace of God, the first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I clearly remember that during that 60 days, it was obvious to me that it wasn't necessary to go to that many of those fool meetings. It was perfectly clear to me that those meetings weren't doing much good. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody, for heaven's sake. But I'd been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had of being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I don't have anywhere else to go. We have nearly killed one another, and we got to keep on going to these dumb old meetings." And a minute ago I said it was the nightmare that I'd go back and forth between being too great for this program and too bad for it. Here's the sunshine, guys. The sunshine is that those meetings worked just as well as if I had thought, felt, and believed they were exactly what I needed. I had it all backwards. I thought in order for it to work, I had to believe it would work. I thought for it to work, it had to feel like it was working. The truth is, I thought I had to be able to see the causal relationship of A causing B had nothing on earth to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind the raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, "I've read it several times." And they said, "We know you've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying, dummy." They said, "You've got it in your head that that book is some sort of philosophy book, that there's something in there that you can learn or master that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety." They said, "Partner, it ain't going to happen." I said, "There's nothing in that book that you can learn that will keep you sober for a heartbeat. In fact," they said, "the big book, Don, is not the solution to your alcoholism." And I said, "Wait a minute. You have been telling me for 2.5 years that that book is the solution to my alcoholism, and now you're telling me it isn't?" And they said, "Don, we never told you the book was the solution to your alcoholism. What we told you is that the action described in that book is the solution to your alcoholism." They said, "Don't buy this deal that recovery is a learning process." Said, "You got to learn just a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit." Said, "In your case, you've had enough information about recovery for 2 years to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without learning one single new piece of information about recovery." They said, "What's killing you is not what you know and don't know. What is killing you is what you're doing and not doing. And what recovery really is an action process. And what this book really is a simple instruction manual for your actions." That's when they explained that I'd be a member of this wonderful fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking, but I'm not even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous unless I'm somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9 the way that book says, or having done that, I'm living a day at a time on 10, 11, and 12 in order to do that action that I talked about that gets us our daily reprieve. And they said, "If you do that, if you grab hold of this fellowship like a parasite and don't do the steps, you might stay dry for a week, or you might stay dry 30 years. But if you do it that way, you'll have no healing of what's really wrong. You'll have no healing of that disordered ego. you'll have no healing of that inability to be comfortable inside yourself, that emptiness and that pain inside you, except just exactly as you do these steps the way the book says do them. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night and ask a power greater than myself and thank that power. Tears came to my eyes, and I said, I can't do that. I've been trying for 2.5 years to make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing the way you guys do, or it looks like to me you do, and I can't change anything. I can't change one single thought, feeling, or belief. And they said, well, Don, you've got that backwards, too. And I'm sure my mouth fell open, because at the core of this insane, disordered ego of mine is this conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. My Lord, we can't have me doing something I don't feel like doing. You know, it'd just be awful. Let me tell you how ingrained that is. Right today, if I wake up Monday morning and don't feel like doing the next right thing, it's not going to occur to me to go and do the right thing whether I feel like it or not. I'm going to want to call one of y'all and get you to help fix me so I feel like doing right. Because, you see, without divine intervention, that's the way it always is. And I'm going to give you some really bad news. In the time that I've been sober, I have worried sponsors to death trying to get me to feel right so I can do right. I have prayed until I was blue in the face, trying to get to feel right so I could do right. I have done enough inventories that if they were all stacked up, they'd probably come somewhere between my knee and my hip, trying to get me to feel like doing right so I could do right. And I've also spent a fair amount of money on outside counseling, trying to get me to feel right so I can do right. Here's the bad news. Not one single time has anything made me feel like doing right except going on doing right when I don't feel like it. And I just absolutely hate that. It's just almost more maturity than I can possibly stand. And they said, well, no, Don. Said, we would never suggest you think, feel, or believe anything. Said, in the first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. They said, in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die will be determined solely by what you do. So they said, if you want to live, get down on your knees, start saying those words. Don't worry about what's going through your brain because it won't count. Somewhere in April of 81, I started getting on my knees and saying those words, purely acting as if. The miracle of the second step began to happen. I began to come to believe. And from the time I started getting down there, to my knowledge, I hadn't missed a morning or night. Now, I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. The reason I'm telling you that is at least half the time in all those thousands of mornings and nights since April of 81, I hadn't really wanted to get down there. A whole lot of time I could have gotten a doctor's excuse that I didn't feel like getting down there. I could have gotten a bunch of affidavits from judges and lawyers that I didn't have time to get down there. A whole lot of mornings it was clear to me it wasn't doing any good. But I've gotten down there every morning, and I've gotten down there every night, and something's worked every single day. I've done my school of sponsorship. I don't tell people what they have to do because, you see, I do so well just to know what I need to do. But I do tell folks that I sponsor, please don't ask me to give you any hints on how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night because I don't have any experience in it. I've been absolutely unable to do it. It's the only way I know to keep Don Major sober. And that's the second most important thing in my sobriety every day of my life. The most important is real simple. Today, just for today, with God's help and yours, I'm not going to drink or take dope if my butt falls off. Because, you see, I almost died not understanding that powerless over alcohol does not mean powerless over my elbow. There are some things that other people can't and won't do for you and God won't do for you. And one of those things is knocking a drink or some dope out of your hand. I have tried and tried before I got sober to find some way to abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. And there's no way in the world to do it. I find out that when I'm willing to go ahead and make that effort, that I get all the help in the world. And for you new folks, a day at a time, I hadn't wanted to drink or drug for over 24 years. But I would never have lived to get to that point if I hadn't have become willing to do the first mature things I'd ever done in my life. Understand that I was not powerless over my elbow and that I had to be mature in that action. I had to do some things I really didn't want to do. And I had to not do some things I thought I was going to explode if I didn't do them. I want to talk a little bit about sobriety, and I'm going to let y'all get out of here in just a few minutes. I'm sorry I'm wound up, and if any of y'all get done before I do, just go on. I'll leave when I'm done. They led me through the third step in Nashville, got it through my head that that's just a decision, that I'm going to, but it's a critical one. It's the first action step. They explained to me that if you don't know whether or not you've done the third step, don't worry about it because you hadn't. You know, if you hadn't gone in a room with an understanding person and gotten on your knees and said words like the third step prayer and meant for that to be the moment when you started trying to do it God's way instead of yours and you committed to do the rest of the steps, you hadn't done the third step Alcoholics Anonymous. Then they got it. They led me through steps 4 and 5. They explained that I had to do an inventory at once after my third step or it would evaporate. So sure enough, 8 months later at once, I did a fourth step. But I was working on my fourth step in my mind. And, you know, I kept hearing these silly things like, it's impossible to start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper. And I'd say, well, you don't understand, though. I need to figure this out so I can get it down on paper. And then I'd hear things like, Don, taking your inventory is not new, son. You have never found any subject nearly as enchanting as yourself. Said, you have spent 37 years trying to figure you out. What made you tick? What was wrong with you? Said, you can't take your inventory, but if you'll come to this book like a little child, and you'll go through it line for line, and you'll follow those directions, it'll be like a child following the dots to form a picture. God and the big book will do what you can't do. Your inventory will emerge. So I did the fourth and fifth step, formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to look like. I blew past step 6 and 7, thought that was where, with God's help, I went to work on me to make me into what I'd decided a spiritual Don ought to look like. As a pure byproduct of doing steps 8 and 9, when I was about a year and a half sober, and to my great surprise, my law license got put back in order. January of 1983, I went back to Louisville and went into law practice. Second month I was there. By God, incidents, I talked at the Kentucky State Convention in front of 2,000 people. People started saying nice things to me. Will you talk here? Will you be my sponsor? Will you do this? Same month, I saw my daughter Dana for the first time in over 3 years. Dana moved in with me 2 months later, lived with me all through high school, and she's going to give me my second grandchild next May, Lord willing, and she's been in Al-Anon over 20 years, and we're dear friends. The first 9 years of my sobriety were great. They were wonderful. I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week at least. I've always done what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those first 9 years were just enchanted. But relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me in those first 9 years. And I was working so hard on my character defects. And the ones I was working on, guys, were the ones that were making me uncomfortable. The ones that were inconsistent with this little picture I had of what a spiritual Don ought to be. You see, just because I had dressed that up in spiritual clothing, I had declared it not to be a self-determined objective. It was just as much a self-determined objective as determining I was going to try to get myself a red Ferrari. You see, this deal is not about making me comfortable. Making me comfortable happens as a byproduct of not worrying about that and following the directions. Comfort is impossible to get by seeking it. I've got to follow the directions. I've got to reach out to you. You see, I could have quoted the seventh step prayer backwards, but I didn't realize it wasn't real to me what that prayer really meant. What it asks, of course, is for God to remove the defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, and I don't have a clue which ones they are. And as long as I'm praying for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone, because it's making my self-centered butt uncomfortable, I might as well be praying for that Ferrari. Because the book tells me it won't work, I can easily see why. And as far as 6 and 7 being where I went to work on me with God's help, The 12 and 12 specifically quotes a big old book that is not conference approved, and Bill's story in the big book refers to that same passage. And what that passage is of myself I am nothing, and the Father does the work. I can no more successfully work on any of my other character defects than I worked on drinking and taking dope. This deal is not about merit. This deal is about grace, guys. And we've already had some conversations, especially with Kelly this morning, but I do want to say, and I don't want to be controversial, and I believe the big book with all my heart. God filled this world with great doctors and counselors, and we shouldn't hesitate to use them. But I believe if we try to take our alcoholism to those poor folks, instead of taking our alcoholism to these 12 steps, it's about like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. And we're standing on a whale's back fishing for minnows. And what I'm getting at is, God, please deliver me from issues. I don't want any issues. In my sobriety, and I really, there's some science in this, I figure I hear 40 or 50 a week. So I think I've heard about 20,000 issues in the last 24 years. I've never heard a single issue that wasn't all about how that person felt. I've never heard a single issue that didn't fit right squarely into one of the three parts of the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's either resentment, fear, or sex. And here's the bottom line. The reason I really don't want issues, of those 20,000 that I've heard of, I'm not aware of a single one that ever got satisfactorily and permanently resolved. So I don't want issues. I don't know what to do with them. I want character defects. I know what to do with those. Guys, I started stumbling in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober that way. I started trying to do the stitching instead of figuring out the pattern and letting God do it, make the pattern for me. And I've done it so poorly, just stumbling and getting up. But my God seems tickled to death with persistence. If when I was 9 years sober, I'd made a list of everything I wanted in this life, in every area, spiritual, material, professional, family, AA, and God had said, I'm sick of your whining, Don. I'm going to give you exactly what you've written down as the best you could imagine. I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to come to my God like a little child and quit trying to figure out the pattern and understand my job's stitching, the only glimpse of my God's will I ever get is in the right now. And it's all about my action. If I think I've got a glimpse of God's will for you, I'm nuts. If I think I've got a glimpse of God's will for me an hour from now, I'm nuts. Because the only glimpse I get is just that little spark of the divine that tells me where to stitch. Tell you real quickly some of the things that have happened in these last 15 and a half years. Some of the folks here, Polly and Dave, I think, have met my wife, Sharon. Sharon and I have got a great relationship, and we'll be married 15 years next month. The Bar Association that kicked me out has given me so many honors that it's just embarrassing. And I used to not talk about this because I was afraid people would think that I was bragging. But I have told you guys what I did with my life. That Bar Association that kicked me out very loudly, and there wasn't a lawyer in Kentucky that would have peed on me if I was on fire when I got kicked out of the bar. And they were right. They have put me on a committee to interview people that want to be judged to pass on whether they're qualified. They made me chairman of that committee. They made me a master at the end of court where I sat there side by side with people that are one step from the Supreme Court of the United States. The most famous, powerful judges and lawyers in Kentucky, and one little drunk criminal lawyer. They gave me an award. They called me a couple of years ago and said, Don, we want to make sure you come to the Bar Association dinner. They gave me the Pro Bono Lawyer of the Year Award for doing free legal work for folks. And about a year ago, I guess it took the cake, I got a call from the president of the state bar, and he said, Don, we have got a vacancy on the ethics committee. And what's so hilarious about that is the first 10 years I practiced law, the only people I was more afraid of than the state ethics committee were the IRS and the FBI. But for you new people, please keep coming back. I mean, the miracles, we are the only people I know that are so accustomed to miracles that we just take them for granted. And when we get up here, for you new folks, when we get up here and tell these stories, we're not making this stuff up. I really did live without a home. I really did lose everything. I really did destroy everything in this life. And simply by the grace of God, coming here and following simple directions, taking that stitch a day at a time, I've been given a life that I couldn't even imagine. And it can happen for you. This is the vision for all of us. It'll work, and I love you, everyone, and thank you.